With the slowness of spreading oil, she rose to face into the darkness where he was. She slipped the scalpel into the palm of her left hand, and she drew back her right arm with the chain and iron cuff dangling from her fist, ready to strike. Then she pitched the scalpel with a short, underhanded throw, judging the distance to drop it close enough to force him to move again, but far enough to make him move away from her. The tiny missile struck something soft, the sound muted, almost lost in other small sounds, but then it slithered softly along the deck, like a hesitant footfall, and instantly light flooded the hold. Tipu's monstrous shape sprang out of the darkness, huge, menacing, unbelievably close. He held the unhooded lantern high in his left hand, and the yellow light glistened on the bare round dome of his yellow skull, and on the broad plain of his back, the muscle rippling and tensing into valleys and ridges as he swung back the heavy club in his right hand, his head hunched down on the thick corded neck. He was facing away from her, but only for an instant. As he realized that there was nobody in front of him, he reacted with animal swiftness, ducking the great round head onto his chest, beginning to swing away. She moved entirely by instinct. She swung the heavy iron manacle on the length of chain. It hummed in a glittering circle in the lamplight, and it caught Tipu high on the temple with a crack like a branch breaking in a high wind. And the thin layer of yellow scalp opened like the mouth of a purse with a crimson velvet lining. Tipu swayed drunkenly on straddled legs that started to buckle under him. She pulled back the chain and swung again with all the weight of her body and the strength of her fear behind the stroke. Again, a deep red wound bloomed on the polished yellow dome of his skull, and he went down slowly onto his knees, an attitude she had seen him adopt so often as he prayed on the quarterdeck, making the Muslim obeisance towards Mecca. Now again, his forehead touched the deck, but this time with his blood dribbling into a puddle under it. The lantern clattered onto the deck, still burning, and in its light Tipu rolled heavily onto his side, with his breath snoring in his throat and his eyes rolled up into his head, glaring ghastly white and unseeing, his thick legs kicking out convulsively. Robin stared at the prostrate giant, aghast at the damage she had done, already feeling a need to administer to any hurt or crippled being. But it lasted for only seconds. As Tipu's eyes rolled back into their deep sockets, she saw the pupils beginning to focus. The yellow, gleaming body heaved. The movement of limbs was no longer spasmodic, but more coordinated and determined. The head lifted, still lolling, but swinging questingly from side to side. Unbelievably, the man was no longer crippled by those two cutting blows. Had been stunned for seconds only. In seconds more, he would be fully conscious, and in his fury, more dangerous than ever. With a sob, Robin flew at the open hatch of the lazaretto. As she passed him, cruel fingers hooked at her ankle, pulling her off balance so she almost fell before she could kick herself free and dive through the opening. Tipu was on hands and knees in the light of the fallen lantern, creeping towards her as she threw all her weight against the hatch. As it thudded into its jam, she dropped the locking bar into its seating, and at that moment Tipu's shoulder crashed into the far side of the hatch with a force that shook it in its frame. Her frantic fingers were so clumsy that it took three attempts to secure the padlock and chain, and only then could she sink to the deck and sob away her fear, until her relief came to buoy her up and give her renewed strength. When she dragged herself to her feet, she was light-headed, intoxicated with the strange, fierce jubilation that she had never felt before. She knew it sprang from having fought herself out of danger, from the unfamiliar experience of inflicting punishment on a hated adversary. And she knew she would feel guilt for it later, but not now. The keys were still in the door between the lazaretto and saloon, where she had left them. She pushed the door open quickly and paused in the opening an instant, feeling the quick flare of alarm overtake her feeling of elation. She had only an instant of time to realize that somebody had trimmed the saloon lamp, and then fingers seized her wrist from behind and swung her off balance, bearing her down heavily to the deck and holding her there with one arm twisted up between her shoulder blades. "Keep still, damn you, or I'll twist your head off your shoulders." Mungo St. John's voice was low and fierce in her ear. Her arm holding the chain was trapped under her, and now her captor shifted his weight over her, placing his knee in the small of her back, and bearing down so painfully that she wanted to cry out with the agony that flared up her curved spine. "Tibu flushed you out quickly enough," St. John murmured with grim satisfaction. "Now let's have a look at you, before we stretch you out on the grating." He reached forward and pulled off the cloth cap that covered her head, and she heard his little grunt of surprise as her hair tumbled loose in a slippery, shining mass in the lamplight. His grasp slackened, and the pressure of his knee into the base of her spine eased. Roughly, he grasped her shoulder to turn her on her back so he could see her face. She rolled easily towards him, and then, as her trapped arm came free, she hurled the chain at his face. He threw up both hands to catch the blow. As slippery as an eel, she wormed out from under him and flew at the door to the saloon. He was quick, quicker than she was, and his fingers were steely. They caught in the thin, worn flannel of her shirt, and it ripped from her collar to the hem. She turned and lashed at him with the chain again, but now he was ready for her, and he caught her wrist, trapping her. She kicked wildly at his shins, and succeeded in hooking an ankle behind his heel, and they went down together in a tangle onto the wooden deck, and Robin found herself carried along by a fierce, uncaring madness. She was hissing and snarling like a cat as she raked at his eyes with her nails, raising a bloody line down his neck. The tatters of her shirt flapped around her waist, and the coarse, dark hair of his chest rasped against the tender points of her naked breasts, so that dimly in her madness she realized that he wore only breeches, and the man's smell of his body filled her nostrils as he tried to smother her wild struggles with his body. She reached up towards him with her open mouth, trying to sink her teeth into that flushed, handsome face. But he caught a handful of her hair at the back of her head and twisted it. The pain seemed to flow down through her body and explode at the base of her belly in a warm, soft spasm that took her breath and crammed it down into her lungs. He held her helplessly, and she felt the strength going out of her, to be replaced by spreading languor. And she stared up into his face with a kind of wonder, as though she had never seen it before. She saw his teeth were very white, his lips drawn back into a rictus of emotion, and fierce yellow eyes, unfocused and smoky, with a kind of madness that matched her own. She made one last feeble effort to repel him, driving her knee upwards, aimed at the fork of his lower body. But he trapped it between his thighs, and then, holding her thus, he reared up over her and looked down at her bare bosom. "Sweet Mother of God," he croaked, and she saw the cord strained tight in his throat, saw the hot yellow fire in his eyes, and she could not move. Not even when he freed his hooked fingers from the twisted tresses of her hair and ran them slowly down her body, cupping first one tight small breast and then the other in the palm of his hand. She felt his touch had gone, though the memory lingered on her skin like butterfly's wings. Then his fingers were back, tugging demandingly at the fastenings of her breeches. She closed her eyes and refused to let her mind consider what was about to happen. She knew that there was nothing she could do to escape, and cried out softly with the strange elation of the martyr. But her cry seemed to touch something deep in him. The smoky yellow eyes focused for a moment. The predatory expression of the face became uncertain, and then tinged with horror as he looked down at her spread white body. Swiftly, he rolled away from her. "Cover yourself," he said harshly, and she was overwhelmed with a cold avalanche of loss, followed immediately by as great a rush of shame and of guilt. She scrambled to her knees, clutching her clothing around her, suddenly shivering, but not with cold. "You should have not have struggled," he said. And though he was obviously fighting to control it, his voice shook as hers did. "I hate you," she whispered foolishly. And then it became true. She hated him for what he had aroused in her, for the sickness and the guilt that followed it, and for the sense of loss and bereavement with which he had left her. "I should kill you," he muttered, not looking at her. "I should have Tipu do it." She felt no fear at the threat. She had rearranged her clothing as best she could, but still she knelt opposite him. "Go!" he almost shouted at her. "Get back to your cabin." She rose slowly, hesitated a moment, and then turned to the companionway. "Dr. Ballantyne." He stopped her, and she turned back. He had risen, and now he stood beside the door to the lazaretto, the keys in his one hand, the slave cuff and chain in the other. "It would be best not to tell your brother of what you discovered tonight." His voice was controlled now, cold and low. "I would not have the same scruples with him. We will be at Cape Town in 4 days," he went on. "After that, you may do as you will. Until then, you will not provoke me again. One chance is already too many." She stared at him mutely, feeling small and helpless. "Good night, Dr. Ballantyne." She hardly had time to pack her breeches and torn shirt away in the bottom of her chest, inspect and rub a salve on her bruises, pull on her nightdress and climb into her narrow bunk, before someone pounded on the cabin door. "Who is it?" she called huskily and breathless, not yet fully recovered from the night's stresses. "Sissy, it's me," Zuga's voice. "Someone has beaten Tipu's skull in. He's bleeding all over the deck. Can you come?" Robin glowed with a fierce spark of pagan glee, which she tried immediately to suppress with less than complete success. "I'm coming." There were three men in the saloon, Zuga, the second mate, and Tipu. Mungo St. John was not there. Tipu sat stolidly on a stool under the oil lamp, naked except for his cotton loincloth, and his neck and shoulders ran with sheets of dark, slick blood. The second mate held a wad of grubby cotton to his skull, and when Robin lifted it away, the wounds began spurting merrily. "Brandy," she demanded, and rinsed her hands and her instruments in the spirit. She was an admirer and believer in the teachings of Jenner and Lister, before she probed the points of her forceps into the open wound. She gripped the vessels and twisted them closed. Tipu made no move, his expression never changed, and she was still carried along on the pagan mood, in direct defiance to the oath of Hippocrates, which she had sworn.